Hello, I'm Matthew Quither, and welcome to this Jericho Chambers podcast of my evening interview with Justin King. It was recorded in early November 2018. I once wrote about guests, and I kind of blush because they were my purple prose days, that he is Britain's grosser answer to Russell Crowe's Maximus Decimus Meridius, minus the furs and the violence. You're a classic, classless, Mars-trained meritocrat from Solihull. Your dad was a civil servant turned petrochemical salesman, and your mum, of whom we often hear, was a housewife who shopped at Sainsbury's. You're the eldest of four boys, and you've described yourself as always a gobby young shite, your words, not mine. You went to Bath University, where you read business administration, and then you joined Mars, along with almost everybody one comes across at a certain age in British business. You went from Mars to Pepsi. You then went to Grand Met, where you famously walked around with a suitcase of samples of Haagen-Dazs with the dripping out of the bottom. And then, I suppose in many ways, your first big break was M&S head of food, which was a great job to have then.
And it was fabulous.
In 2004, however, you ascended to the corporate throne. You took over as CEO at Sainsbury's and embarked on what became a legendary turnaround process called making Sainsbury's great again. And it did need to be made great again because as a supplier, you said, citing your own experience, negotiations with Sainsbury's were a deeply odious experience. And the story that you've told is that when you told your mum that you'd got the M&S job, she was brimful of happiness. But when you told her about the Sainsbury's job, she burst into tears because she said they were crap. So in you went, and you fought a number of takeover battles, including with the extraordinary figure of Robert Cengiz, now a legendary sort of individual in reality TV, as we see. But most importantly, you presided over 35 consecutive quarters of growth, probably more, you'll correct me on that. And when you, very importantly for me, in 2013, you were Management Today's most admired leader in the UK. What I've always found interesting about this guy is this kind of ease, this natural ability he's got to be a boss and a leader and a communicator. And I've seen him in many situations, right from people in working the tills in your supermarkets through senior kind of business people, analysts and all the rest of it. And you're very good with all of them. You're mercurial in the way you can kind of, you can shift. And I think that's probably because what he has got, and I'm not going to overflatter him here, is that thing that we did talk about a lot a few years ago, and that was the kind of the A word, authenticity. Yeah. I never felt with you that it was kind of a forced thing. I didn't feel you'd been kind of media trained particularly, although I'm sure you kind of endured some of that and probably told them how they should be kind of telling you to do it. But you were really good at what you did. And, you know, for someone who was a kind of quite sceptical business journalist, you certainly convinced me and bowled me over. You could talk milk quotas, decent deals for farmers. You could talk about negotiating with Coke on behalf of the customer. Anyway, you did 10 years there. And after that, you had this interesting dalliance when we spoke a couple of times with Formula One, during the course of which you were described as bloody disgusting by Bernie Eccleston, which, again,
as a very positive endorsement.
Exactly. One of Bernie's kind of milder epithets. And then you found your berth in private equity at Guy Hans Terra Firma. And you've maybe been less in the public eye since then, and that's maybe inevitable. It's the nature of the beast that private equity doesn't work in the way in which a FTSE 100 company does. But it was very interesting last weekend that when at the top of the FT site you had 70 business people signing a letter warning about the dangers of the wrong kind of Brexit, your name was the one that was mentioned. Made me think, well, what's the right kind of Brexit? But anyway, we'll save that for later. So please welcome Justin King, everyone.
Thank you.
Now, my first one, I'm afraid, has to be, are you glad you're not running a supermarket now at the moment? We had Charlie Mayfield saying in September, we must all feel the jeopardy of what's going on in retail right now. I'm not going to try and soft soap anyone and say it'll be okay and that the sun will be coming out soon. And that was an alarming thing to hear from the head of the John Lewis Partnership, whom we expect when other people are going through tricky times to be kind of positive and on the front foot.
Not in the way I think you're posing the question. Look, I mean, I you said I did 10 years. I feel like I've done my time. And you know, I was often asked when I left Sainsbury's, you know, do you sort of miss it? Do you regret leaving? And you know, boy, you couldn't do a job like running Sainsbury's and not miss it and think that that was some of the best years of your life. I mean, otherwise you shouldn't have done it. But I realise it's a bit like a sort of reformed smoker. You know, most people, any ex-smokers in the room? Mm-hmm. Most ex-smokers, you say, do you regret giving up? They say no. But then they say, but I would like another fag. And, you know, I feel a bit that way about it. So in the sense that you're asking that question, no, not at all. You know, look, times are tough, of that there's no doubt. But I do think, it's like, what's that line about, you know, nostalgia isn't what it's always been. Everybody thinks that today's time, because they're having to deal with it, is the worst of times. And the reality is there have been many, many challenging times along the way too. You know, when the economy was deeply in recession, was a fundamentally difficult time to be doing business, when consumers, most of your customers, aren't able to make ends meet week to week. So there are unique and different challenges today. But I think you also have to remember it's in the nature of the beast of being a chief exec, particularly of a public, either formally public, like most of the supermarkets are, or in effect public, like John Lewis has become. You talk your own game because you have to. And there's a very fine line to be trod. You know, I always felt that it didn't make a lot of sense to be on Declan early in the morning saying, woe is me, because retail is a momentum business and consumers want to feel like they're actually contributing to success. They really do. And so I never quite understood, you know, if a retail CEO is standing up saying, you don't know how shit it is. I think a whole bunch of consumers think there's a comma, which is in our shops. And I don't want consumers to be hearing that. So I always felt you have to say, that's our job to deal with those challenges. Meanwhile, what we're trying to do is the right thing for our customers. And I have to say, I hear less of that narrative now. And I think that is at least part of the problem.
What would you do at the moment? I mean, it does look really hard out there. And, I mean, you must have thought about kind of things you'd change, approaches that you'd alter.
I don't really, because, you know, it's not my job now. And, you know, I'm very fortunate. It's always been part, I think, of what's helped me in my career is that I have an off button. You know, I can go home in the evening and switch it off and not feel the need to kick the can and shout at the children because I've had a bad day at work. And so that I've always felt very fortunate. You know, I sleep at night because I don't lie awake worrying about things. My partner says that's because I'm a sociopath as opposed to that I have a clear conscience. But, you know, so I don't, you know, worry a lot about things that I don't have anything to do with anymore. That said, I think there is a core truth in retail, which is that retail exists to represent consumers in the supply chain. You know, that's what retail exists for. You know, Sainsbury's was founded in 1869 in Drury Lane, you know, not a million miles from here. And they came into existence, as did many retailers and many of the brands that we still know today, because consumers had become detached from the supply chains from which they bought their food, the urbanising population in a post-industrial revolution world. And the intermediaries between the producer of the goods, farmers, and the consumer of the goods were untrustworthy. People were literally dying from the food that they ate. There were a number of contamination and poisoning scandals in the mid-Victorian era. And so it wasn't a metaphor. Retailers put their name above the door. Manufacturers put their name on the tin and said, trust me, I will be your representative in the supply chain. And one of the things that I think is at the core of every retail failure is when they lose sight of that core truth. Your job is to sit around the customer's side of the table facing into a supply chain that is metaphorically trying to kill them. That was literally true 150 years ago, and it remains essentially true still today. And when retailers fail, and it was the core of Sainsbury's failure, they actually started to think that they, through having this unique intermediary role, could nick money from the supply chain and nick money from the consumer as well. And that's why you fail. So the answer to your question is, focus on what sitting the right side of the table means in today's world.
Do you think that what's going on out there at the moment on the high street in the UK is uniquely difficult, or is it something that is going to be cyclical and will inevitably get better? I mean, you must sort of think ahead over the next 5 years and how it might look and how it might change.
Well, look, essentially that's a tipping point question. You know, have we reached that tipping point? It's uniquely difficult in the sense that some of the factors that are causing the challenges are different now than they were in previous times. It's not unique in that, you know, for example, up until only two quarters ago, the total amount of retail space in the UK has been expanding continuously since 2010, the last time it declined. So this idea that somehow there has been this massive implosion in the last number of years simply isn't true. I think you are seeing a very unique factor, which is CVAs. CVAs have started to be embraced by many retailers, particularly retailers, not only. And, you know, I have to sort of say here, we used a CVA to save Manor Formula One. So I'm a spectacular hypocrite when I say that I think CVAs probably do more harm than good. But they have become the only tool, really, that some retailers believe they have to change the dynamic in their relationship with landlords. And, you know, whilst, you know, landlords probably kind of picked a good one to fight with in terms of Mike Ashley, it is a bit rich, landlords claiming that they're somehow hard done by this process. You know, they have all the power in the relationship, upward-only rent reviews. I can't tell you I've ever had a sensible, long-term conversation with a landlord. It's all, this is the rent and this is the rent review. And those chickens are coming home to roost. Vast majority of the high street, so-called, in the UK is over-rented against what the cash flow potential is from that real estate. Landlords are taking too high a proportion of that cash flow potential, and there needs to be a reset, or this will be a tipping point. I don't think it will be a tipping point for consumer reasons, because actually people like doing shopping in real shops with real people, notwithstanding the fact that they have lots of other choices. They do today, still do, and almost every internet-based business I talk to is working out how they still have a physical or create for the first time a physical presence. You know, when I'm asked that question in the past, I would say, what is the most significant retail transaction in the world in the last 10 years? Amazon bought Whole Foods, it seems to me. Yeah. I think that's the most significant transaction. Hands up anyone who thinks Amazon bought Whole Foods for technology reasons. Right? They bought them, I think, for two reasons. One, because they believed that Whole Foods knew how to do shops, and one, because they believe Whole Foods know how to do supply chains. And most tech businesses really, really don't get those two things in a big way. So I'm an optimist for the high street. I think there's a massive reset going on. I think there is too much space and it is over-rented. I've long advocated that the single most powerful solution for the high street is planning, because in simple terms, what most councils should do is draw a line down the middle of their high street and say, that side of the line, we want to stay retail forever. We're going to invest in the infrastructure. We're going to invest in the public domain. We're going to make sure the public car park doesn't smell of piss. We're going to have lighting, cover from the rain. We're going to make it easy to come in. We're not going to make the primary mission of our parking attendants to steal money from you if you overstay for 30 seconds. And the rest of the high street can go to other use, commercial, domestic. You know, we need people to move back and live in towns. Mm-hmm. And they, by the way, they want to do that. And I think if you did that, you would solve a number of social problems and at the same time create a sustainable long-term future.
Okay. Now let's take you back a bit, because it was a great spectator sport, you and Terry Leahy knocking spots off each other, and you were fascinatingly different characters. I remember you telling me, before they kind of came unstuck, they're running that business too hot, was your expression. What did you mean by that? I think it's referring to a car engine, isn't it, originally? And how did you know that? What was it about what they were doing? Because you knew everything they were doing, they knew everything you were doing. And you two were incredible rivals. So just take us through what you knew about what was going on and how that business was being run and how it was different from what you were doing then.
Look, the metaphor came to the point they made from the first car I ever owned, which was a blue Mark I Ford Escort with a blown head gasket, which I couldn't afford to replace. And so whenever I stopped it, I could take the key out, lock the door, and be halfway across the car park, and it would still be running, at which point it would go and stop. And, you know, the metaphor worked incredibly well for me for Tesco, because I could see that they had stopped the car, parked it, switched off the key and got out of the car against the idea that they were sitting on the side of the consumer. Somewhere around 2007-08, I could see that change in their trading proposition, their approach to pricing, the veracity with which they chased prices down when we did, what they were doing to the quality of the products that they sold, the standards in store, the way they started to talk about one in front, as if that was somehow a good thing for consumers, that they were going to put more people on once they'd started queuing. It's like, well, nice idea, put them on before they start queuing. Seems to me to be a much better customer-facing idea. So I could see that all in the way that they ran the business, and I could see it in the numbers too, because the numbers quite clearly meant that they could only be doing one thing, which is widening gross margin. And if you're widening gross margin, you're nicking money off consumers. I mean, that's... Everyone pretends it's something other than that, but it's nicking money off consumers. Now, it might be money they're happy for you to nick off them if you're doing something better for them at the same time. I've sometimes talked about profit as what customers willingly leave behind for the great job that you've just done for them. And so I could see all of that, and therefore I knew at some point in time, whilst Terry was walking across the car park, that car was going to stutter and stop. Now, as it happens, if I really stretch the metaphor, he'd left the car park, climbed into another car, and driven to the next county before it stalled. But sure as eggs is eggs, that's what happened.
What about booking sales before, you know, they'd actually happen? Which is a different thing altogether, isn't it? Did you know that was going on?
Well, that's not what they did, I don't think.
Well, what did they do?
Subject to the usual caveat, okay. This is subject of a legal case, and therefore... A judge and jury will decide what actually happened. The essence of the case is that they were recognising income before it was due, and that they were recognising income that they knew they had no real prospect of getting. And a big part of any retailer P&L are checks. Suppliers, beyond selling you the goods that they sell you for you to merchandise at a price, will pay for certain things. They'll pay for promotions, they'll pay for new listings, they will pay for growth, most notably. So we'll charge you X for our goods, but if at the end of the year, when we've added it all up, we've grown 10% with you, we'll give you a 1% overrider, is what it would typically be called, rebate. And the core of the case is that Tesco continued to book those to their P&L long after it became clear that the suppliers weren't going to actually pay because they weren't achieving the targets set. Now, I spent the first half of my career as a supplier, and I can't tell you how many times I had conversations with retailers saying, I know we agreed the overrider was for 10%, we've only grown 4%, but can we still have it, please? And, you know, I learned in a business called Mars, where, because we were cocky little gobshites, where you'd say, which bit of 10% didn't you understand when you signed the piece of paper? But actually, most suppliers don't have powerful enough brands that they can really say that. And that's the core of the case.
Did they have a particularly bullying culture in buying at Tesco? And I mean, that's one of the things that they grew notorious for. That, you know, I remember being told by a young graduate trainee who came to us at Management Today after he'd left, and he put in the meat department, and the stories he told us kind of made your kind of hair stand on end about, you know, getting these guys to walk up the stairs, giving them a cup of coffee that was brimful, screaming at them about their last delivery. I mean, was there that kind of culture there that made them any different, or were you all like that?
Well, no, you... no, actually, there's a survey which is done every year by an independent organisation called the Mirror, a survey, not the Daily Mirror, Mirror as in look in it, which most of the major grocers subscribe to, which measures in a very objective way and over time exactly the answer to that question. For my entire time at Sainsbury's, Mike Coop, who was my trading director, for that time. His after hitting sales and margin, his next most important bonus target was being a customer of preference, as measured by that survey. Because I had a very simple view. I came from a supply background. In the end, the only way to represent consumers properly is to be the customer preference. How else can you possibly represent your consumer? Your consumer does not think you're representing them if you're kicking your suppliers half to death. And ultimately, they are your lifeblood in the future, new product development and so on. So they have to be sustainable and profitable, because if they're not, you actually don't have a business model. People won't realise it, but we're currently consuming an Aldi product. And Aldi are famously very easy to deal with, except on one dimension, price. And if you try to go anywhere that's unacceptable on price, Aldi are a really, really, really difficult organisation to deal with. But on everything else, they're really easy. And if you ask most suppliers, they say, actually, I quite like dealing with Aldi because I know what the issue is when I walk through the door, and kind of everything else works quite well. So look, different retailers take different approaches, you know, just as in life. Some bosses think empowering, engaging and motivating people gets great results. Some bosses think kicking your people every day till they hate you but fear you in equal measure gets better results. There is some evidence, actually, the latter often works,
at least in
the short term. And it's no different. But I fundamentally believe that good people can be made to do bad things, because most people are good people, and if you give them the space to be good people, they will be. And the pressure, if you imagine, as my view is, that the line started, you know, the management, so to speak, left the Ford Escort on overrun in 2007. Imagine the pressure come 2012, 5 years in a row, trying to dip for the line and hit a number. It can only manifest itself in one way, which is you get nastier and nastier and nastier with your supply base. And that's what happened. And Dave, being an ex-supplier himself, has clearly set the business the objective of being the customer of choice. And you can see that. I hear that now when I talk to suppliers, that they're seeing that change happen really quite quickly.
But how much did it annoy you that they were so much bigger than you and you could never catch them?
That's a line about size doesn't matter, I suppose. But look, it didn't annoy me in that, you know, because I was often asked the question, you know, is your ambition to overtake Tesco? And
yeah.
I said, look, I arrived in 2004. Sainsbury's had been, had 14 years of consecutive decline when I arrived, been declining since 1990. And the lines crossed between Tesco and Sainsbury's in 1996. And I used to say I'd have to be at Sainsbury's performing at the level we currently are for 20 years to catch up with them. And therefore, it's not my ambition, because my ambition is not to be here for 20 years, but my ambition is to be better than. We averaged, not that I've ever done the maths, 1.9% like-for-like outperformance of Tesco through my 10 years there.
Wallop.
And anyone who knows anything about grocery, 1.9% like-for-like outperformance is like night and day, because they're really high fixed cost businesses, really high fixed cost businesses, much more so. People think manufacturing is high fixed cost. No, it's not. Manufacturing is a doddle to take cost out. You shut a production line, you shut a factory. You know, you can't actually shut a shop, because guess what happens when you shut them? You know, customers stop coming. So they are incredibly fixed cost businesses, and marginal sale, or lack thereof, is the difference between success and failure.
All right. Now, it never does anyone any good to talk about Tesco too much. So let's go on to the M&S who've been in the news today. You know, you must have a place in your heart still for them. What can be done with M&S? Because, you know, they've now got Archie Norman in there, whom you know, who's quite an individual. I mean, is it savable?
Look, if you cast forward 20 years and we were sitting here, M&S will be a big part of the retail landscape in this country in 20 years. I believe that. No, I don't think that's inevitable, because I think a lot of things have to go right to get there. But I think it still starts from a position of strength. Now, you know, I left M&S in 2004, and you told the story of, you know, my mum being really proud when I got the M&S job and staggered that I would be so stupid to go to Sainsbury's. you know, when I left M&S, I mean, I was only there for a short period of time. I ran the food business. We started Simply Foods at that time because I had this sort of simple idea, which is we had the most convenient food in the country in the most inconvenient locations, which seemed to me to be not sitting on the same side of the table as the customer. So here's an idea. Let's put the most convenient food in the country in the most convenient locations. And amazingly, customers thought that was a good idea. But the mantra in the business at the time was we mustn't allow food to have standalone stores, because if we don't have food in our stores, we certainly don't have anything else they're going to come to our stores for. Now, that seemed to me to actually raise an interesting question about what to do with the rest of the offer, not to constrain food from its growth opportunity. But when Steve Rowe launched his current turnaround plans a year or so ago, I still have Luc van der Velde's mobile telephone number in my BlackBerry, as you pointed out earlier. And I texted him and said, word for word, your announcement in 2001. Because it was word for word. And it was word for word on the culture. It was word for word on shutting down the international operations, word for word on the challenge between food and non-food and so on. So there has been, whatever judgment you place on the leadership from 2004 to 2018, not just a lost decade, but a lost decade and a half, where the business is starting today with exactly the agenda that it has 15 years ago. Now, you can't have that time again, clearly. But here's the thing. 50% of all money spent in the UK on clothing is spent by women over the age of 40. 50% of all clothing expenditure. So that includes the fellas in the room, it includes your kids and your grandkids, 50%. M&S's average customer is 53. Wouldn't you want a business and clothing brand focused at a 53-year-old lady? Like, if it didn't exist, you'd go and create it, wouldn't you?
But why can't they get that right?
Because it's really hard. Because my mum is 80 years old and dresses younger than she did when she was 53 years old. Because she's got 12 grandchildren, most of whom are girls, and when she turns up in anything that they consider to be old lady clothes, they virtually take her to her bedroom, rip them off her, and dress her in stuff from Jewels or wherever else. So it's not easy to stay with that changing time. But on the whole, you know, they've clearly said there's 100 or so locations have to go. On the whole, it's still a fantastic real estate in great locations, much loved, but much maligned. You know, so back to my mum. 2004, she was still in I love M&S, I hate Sainsbury's. Today, well, she doesn't, because I don't run Sainsbury's anymore, so she hates it again now. But, you know, today she loves Sainsbury's and she hates M&S because she's finally had enough. But what one of the things we learned at Sainsbury's, we did this thing, we mailed because it was that long ago, but actually, because I fundamentally believe there's a different dynamic when you mail someone. We mailed a million of our customers from the Nectar database with a, in inverted commas, personal letter from me. And I said, you know, hello, I'm the new chief exec. You may have seen that I've just come here. We know you're letting us down. And it was A4 folded, you know, four sides. Please tell us where we're letting us down. And please give us something. You know, what would you like us to sort out first? And then little box at the end saying, please, anything else you'd like to not to tell us. So we did a million of these mailers. So how many of them wrote back? Anyone hazard a guess? Any marketeers in the room? 250,000.
Wow.
Still makes the hairs, actually, stand up on the back of my neck. 250,000 people. Now, most marketeers will tell you if you get 3 or 4%, it would be stunning. Now, in fact, it told us everything that we needed to know. Not that they literally laid out the turnaround plan, but the central thesis was we love Sainsbury's. And we love it because for so long it's done for us exactly what we wanted. What we hate is somewhere along the way in the last period of time you've lost sight of that. Please just go back to being what you were. Mm-hmm. That was the gestation of the Making Sainsbury's Great Again idea, which Donald has still not paid me for, I should say, was that actually there was once a time, it was a truly great business in its own eyes and also in the eyes of the customers whom it served. That didn't mean, you know, it wasn't a back to the future idea, as some people seemed to think it was, you know, sort of just go back and make the stores, you know, put all the colleagues back in brown uniforms circa 1973 and it will all be well with the world. It had to be in a modern context, but the things that we stood for were the things that customers wanted us to be. And it's why, you know, we did a 140-year celebration, which I know is not a kind of well-known anniversary. And Sainsbury's 150-year anniversary is next year, which I'm sure they'll make a massive thing about. But we did this because we were kind of bereft of any marketing ideas at the time. So. And our customers loved it because what it allowed them to do was remember what it was about Sainsbury's that they thought was special. You know, the fact that Sainsbury's was the first retailer in the UK to employ women. Because grocers were a male-only trade until the First World War. And Sainsbury's realised that if all the men were going to war, as we're obviously going to recognise in the weekend ahead, that women had to play a different role in society. Sainsbury's first recycling policy started in the First World War too. In a country bereft of resources, recycling needed to be part of the story. So a lot of the narrative we were talking to in, you know, diversity, recycling, environmental sensitivity in 2015, 16, 17... was a narrative that had been part of the story of Sainsbury's for 100 years.
Mm. Now, to go from Sainsbury's and M&S, things you have a deep residual fondness for, but something when I've spoken to you about, you always kind of flinch, it's Ocado and delivery. You're not convinced when it comes to that at all, are you? You've been telling me for 10 years it's going to be a flash in the pan, it's all going to be over.
I haven't quite been saying that.
Tell me why that doesn't work and you don't think it can work.
No, look, that's not quite what I've said, I should say. Look, Ocado's never made money or a meaningful return on capital and never will unless it truly reinvents itself as a tech business. And it's doing a not bad job of that at the moment, yeah, in terms of selling it worldwide. But fundamentally, building a business, selling £10 notes for £5, doesn't tell you that you're creating something which is a powerful consumer proposition beyond the idea that consumers like buying £10 notes for £5. That's kind of figures. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, the reality is that if you just do the simple maths of the accumulated cash losses, what cash has Ocado consumed in its however many years, it's approximately £10 for every door it's ever knocked on. Negative. Ever knocked on. Not the different ones, every door knock. Now, what we know in today's world, that there are many, many, many businesses being built on that basis, with powerful backing, incredibly strong balance sheets, and allowing themselves over a very long period of time to separate themselves from normal commercial dynamics. I went to a talk by Dara of Uber a couple of weeks ago, and he quite proudly said, we have no intention of making a profit any time in the next 5 to 10 years. Now, that's kind of an astonishing thing. Now, I think there's going to be a whole different debate about whether that's acceptable, because that used to be called predatory pricing. And what he didn't do was complete the sentence, which is, and once we have a monopoly position, we'll price accordingly and achieve a return. And the second bit of the sentence is quite problematic, I would suggest. So the thing about Ocado, which I think has always been overstated, is that it is a minority sport. Grocery shopping online is 6-7% of the market today. 6-7% of the market today, which is 20 years down the journey, with every major retailer and a pure play in Ocado throwing billions at it. So it's not like people haven't tried, and it's 6-7% of the market. Less than 250,000 households, and there are 30 million households in the UK, today do more than 50% of their food shopping online. And 249,500 of them were within about 10 miles of where we're sitting. You know, it's a minority sport, but for many, many, many people, it's part of their total relationship. And that's why grocers have to do it. But I once described online shopping as no different from selling a can of beans below cost. You know, if the price of, if everyone's fighting on beans and you're selling them at 3 pence a can, which is the lowest I've ever sold a tin of Heinz baked beans for in my career that I can remember, then you do it because everyone's doing it and you accept that what comes with that is a shop that you can still make money on. And online is such a pivotal part of most customers' overall relationship with grocery retail that you have to do it and view it as part of the overall mix. And by the way, that is true more generally in retail. Any retailer that believes they can be pure play online or pure pay in store, I believe will be proved wrong. Even ASOS. You know, we'll sit here in 20 years' time and I'll bet you there are ASOS shops.
A sprinkling.
If they're still... Only a sprinkling. Yeah. No. I agree. But fundamentally, consumers, you know, we are going... And this isn't a Brexit point, because this is kind of happening whatever happens. We are on a journey to being a service economy, mm-hmm. a much more service economy. The skills we should be giving our young people are human skills, people skills, interaction skills, because that's going to be the portable skills that take them through life. And ultimately, people, you know, we're social beings. That's what we are. You know, when you do self-scanning in store, there's absolutely no evidence at all that customers who self-scan are young or old. It's a very broad demographic. This sort of perception that young people self-scan and old people still go to the till. Because actually, the miserable old git on a Wednesday, Thursday, you know, wet Wednesday morning really doesn't want to talk to anyone, and they're quite happy to self-scan. And I'm that miserable old git sometimes. But sometimes you do want to actually be served by a human being and have a little chat while you're paying for your shopping. So I'm just a great believer that, you know, ultimately, you know, shopping is a leisure pastime as well as a functional experience. And it's not a leisure pastime online, is it? You know, it's great. The utility is fantastic. It's why we do it. But ultimately, I'm much more upbeat about the fact that people like people and will want to spend time with and talking to people.
Okay.
And by the way, the technology that is enabling the journey at the moment will be the technology that ultimately enables that too.
Right.
Because it will change the nature of the experience. It will free people in store to spend more time talking to customers, not less time talking to customers. The mistake that a lot of people are making is that they view technology as an opportunity to remove people from stores. Mm-hmm. Fundamentally, technology should be an opportunity to improve the customer experience. And you know, I remember the blinding realization hit me. I was walking around a store and we couldn't make self-scan work. We couldn't get the adoption we needed to justify the capital investment because we were thinking about, we're spending all this money, and the reason we're spending all this money is we're going to take all this labour off the front end, and that's why the capital makes sense. Completely lost sight of whose side of the table we were sitting on. And I walked to the front of a store with the store manager, and I stopped, and there were queues on the man tills. And I turned to him and I said, "Oh, you've got queues." And he looked over his shoulder at the self-scan and said, "No, we haven't. There's self-scan available." And in that moment, it hit me. Oh, my God. Our customers want to be served here. And actually, empty tills there made it even worse because they said, "Well, you know, I don't want to be over there." And what our store managers and supervisors on the front end, they'd wrestle the customer. You may even have happened to you. You know, you go to a customer standing on a man till and say, "Come this way, please. You know, use one of these." And it's like, "No, please, I want to stand in this queue and be served by a human being." So, because you can do these mad things when you're chief exec. Mm-hmm. So I banned looking over their shoulder. So I said, if you're a store manager and you walk to the front end and you see queues on your man tills, you man more tills. And if I ever see you look over your shoulder, I'll fire you because you're thinking about the wrong question. And here's the amazing thing. Once Sainsbury's had no queues on the man tills, customers started using the unman ones. Because then we weren't forcing them. Then it was, "Oh, give it a go." Because, you know, no big deal. If it doesn't work out, I'll just go back and I'll go to one of the other tills which haven't got queues on them. And Sainsbury's were the first by about 3 years of any of the grocery retailers to get to 50% self-scan. And it was that moment, seeing that store manager looking in the wrong direction, that was the pivot to that understanding.